Thanks so much for joining us for KUT's Views and Brews Remix on the new pornography of violence with NPR foreign correspondent John Burnett and Pulitzer Prize-winning author and playwright Lawrence Wright. I'm your host, Rebecca McEnroy. Before we begin, I'd like to advise you that this program does contain graphic descriptions of violent behavior and may not be appropriate for all audiences. Let's begin a little bit with this discussion of the new pornography of violence. John, can you give us an overview of what you mean by the new pornography of violence?
Sure. First of all, thank everybody for coming very much to this rather heavy concept. As I heard the promos on the air, I was like, oh my God, what have we gotten ourselves into? The idea, the inception for this came to me as I spent a lot of time on the U.S.-Mexico border, in Mexican border towns, in the places that are the where the worst firestorms of violence happen. And I see individuals, family members, grieving over, a bloodied body out in the street. And so you see that aspect of it. And then when I started to see how there were websites and movies and songs being written about this, glorifying it almost as an entertainment, the contrast between that just really started to get at me, and I wanted to try to explore this, and so that's why I also roped in Larry, because he's such an expert on Islamic extremism. But so kind of a working title that I'm using here in terms of a pornography of violence, which is not a new term, the depiction of violent behavior in a sensational manner so as to arouse a quick, intense emotional reaction. And we're seeing this more and more with the dawn of the internet, in our terms, for recruitment, for a symbolic victory over foes, for ego gratification, and for entertainment.
So let's get some scope of when this kind of started. Could you give us a little overview of how Al-Qaeda kind of thought about the cinematic element of the attacks on 9/11 and the significance of that in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Sure. I guess I would start with February of 1993, when with the first World Trade Center bombing, which was carried out by Ramzi Youssef, who was not a member of Al-Qaeda at the time, but he was an Islamic extremist, and he had an idea for creating a spectacle. And his idea was that he would take a van full of high explosives and park it in the parking garage of the World Trade Center. And he put it against the wall of the North Tower, the south wall of the North Tower, with the idea that it would cave in that tower and it would topple and fall on the other tower and both of them would come down. And he believed, he calculated, that 250,000 people would be killed. And in his mind, that was roughly the toll that America needed to pay for its involvement in the Middle East. There's a legend I could never really track down, but that when he parked the car, he went over to New Jersey across the river and sat on a park bench to watch the show. So it was a sort of a private event for him. The explosion did happen. The towers did not come down. But six people were killed and more than 1,000 were injured, the greatest civilian toll, greatest number of hospital casualties since the Civil War. So it was a big thing at the time. And years later, when Ramzi Youssef was captured and he was flown to the Manhattan Correctional Institute in a helicopter, and they happened to pass by the World Trade Center, one of the FBI agents turned to him and said, "You see, it's still standing." And he said, "It wouldn't be if we had more money." That was, I think, the moment that the whole infectious idea of spectacle entered the mind of the Islamic extremist trend. There was another important point that same year. In August of 1993, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was the number two man in Al-Qaeda, is now number one, was the head of a group in Egypt called Al-Jihad. And that August, he set off a car bomb intending to kill the interior minister. And then in November, he set off another bomb trying to kill the prime minister. And he missed, neither one of those men, or the prime minister was injured, but neither was killed. Two things that were important about that. One was that in the second bombing, a little girl was killed, Shema Abdul-Halim, and hundreds of people in Egypt had been killed at that time, but that little girl's death was just resonated in Egypt. People were furious at him, and her body was carried around on the shoulders of the crowds, and, you know, people were shouting, terrorism is the enemy of God. But the other thing that was important about that is that it was a suicide bombing, the very first Sunni suicide bombing. In 1983, the Shia group Hezbollah in Lebanon had attacked a Marine barracks and using a suicide bomber and the American embassy, but that had never happened. It was a year before the suicide bombings began in the Palestinian territories. So this was an early use of what became Al-Qaeda's trademark. The other thing that he improvised then was the martyrdom tape. And we can talk a little bit more about that later, but that's another part of the Al-Qaeda trademark. Then August of 1998 was the embassy bombings in East Africa. Two American embassies blown up almost simultaneously, 224 people killed, 150 people blinded by the flying glass. And that was a real spectacle, and one that was not likely to be forgotten. But from Al-Qaeda's point of view, there was something lacking. It didn't elicit the response that bin Laden hoped for, which was an American invasion in Afghanistan, which would trap American forces in the same country where the Soviet Union had been essentially destroyed. So in October of 2000, there was another Al-Qaeda attack, this one against an American destroyer, the USS Cole. And this was the first attempt of Al-Qaeda to actually document on film one of its terrorist attacks. 17 sailors were killed, but the cameraman for Al-Qaeda, Fahd al-Kuso, fell asleep. And so Al-Qaeda missed the opportunity to document it. But ever after then, they were making sure that their cameramen were on awake and on duty. Now, then 9/11, you know, when the embassy bombings came out in August of 98, that same month I had written a movie called The Siege, which was about terrorism and which, you know, had a lot of imagery that replicated some of the things that Al-Qaeda was trying to do. Like, evidently, we were thinking along the same lines. But that same month, there was a bombing in South Africa where two people were killed and a little girl lost her leg. And it was because, they said, of the trailers that had appeared in South Africa for the siege. And they bombed Planet Hollywood, which one of the co-stars of the movie, Bruce Willis, was a partial owner of. 9/11. There's nothing like 9/11 in the history of terrorism. There's nothing like 9/11 in many respects that one can compare it to. A German composer, Stockhausen, Klaus Maria Stockhausen, he called it the greatest work of art ever. And one can understand bitterly what he means by that. It was breathtaking. And in the spectacle, it overcame the tragedy of so many lives that were lost in it. The spectacle itself dominated that event. And that's exactly what bin Laden hoped for. It became a trap for Al-Qaeda, because they could never follow up. There was no second act to 9/11, nothing that could equal it, as much as they tried. And in fact, I think in some ways that has protected us. For several years, Zawahiri told his minions, you know, go out, kill people, kill Americans, do as much damage as you can, but if you want to attack America, you have to clear it with us. And there was nothing that came forward that was as potent as that particular operation. Now, Al-Qaeda became paralyzed after 9/11 by the Allied attacks and by the repudiation of people all over the world, including Muslims all over the world. And they were reduced really to making videotapes. And it in some ways emphasized their paralysis because it was all talk and no action. Until 2002, when Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter, was kidnapped and beheaded in Karachi. The man who did that action or confessed to it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the architect of 9/11. So two of the most memorable experiences in, you know, the spectacle of terror were created by the same individual. America went into Iraq in 2003 with our own shock and awe spectacle. And out of that came another figure in Al-Qaeda, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was a thief and a sex offender and a killer at an enormous scale. He sent his father-in-law into a Shia mosque with a suicide bomb and killed more than 100 people at prayer. He blew up the UN headquarters. And notably, in 2004, he beheaded another young American, Nicholas Berg, on video and posted it on the internet. Those actions actually horrified Al-Qaeda. Zawahiri wrote him a letter about the beheadings that he continually practiced and put on videos, saying, "Can't you kill your captives with a bullet?" It was turning the world against Al-Qaeda. But something else was happening. It was spreading the seed of this kind of imagery. And those videos were getting on television and on the internet, and especially by that time, they had reached Mexico.
And something you said when we were talking earlier that I thought was pretty profound was that what these images do and what this spectacle does or tries to do is to humanize the killer and to dehumanize the victims. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the impact of that, and then we'll move on to the Zetas, where we really see this in action at a very profound level.
The, you know, when you're looking at a movie, let's say, you know, it's a Will Smith, you know, in Armageddon type of movie, and you see, you know, all these bombs and planes and stuff, you're not thinking what's going on underneath. The suffering that's happening, you know, that would really be happening is invisible. It's only the spectacle that is overwhelming and thrilling. Exciting to see because it's taboo. It's things that you should never be allowed to see. That was one of the things about 9/11 that was so extraordinary, is this is something I would never have seen. I never thought I would see such a thing like this. And the fact that thousands of people were buried in the rubble is secondary to the overwhelming imagery, which conquers your natural feelings of suffering and empathy. The other thing that is key to the Al-Qaeda approach is the martyrdom tapes, which after such an action, these are posted on the internet and you see the killer. It's a different way of calculating. You know, when there's a suicide bombing, you will hear the tally, you know, 11 people were killed, not counting the bomber, as if that's not a life to be considered. This is the absolute opposite of it. This is the life that we're going to look at. This young man went and sacrificed himself, and he is a martyr. Well, they have to call him a martyr, because in Islam, suicide is absolutely taboo. In the Quran, suicide is strictly forbidden. The Prophet Muhammad said that the punishment for the act of suicide would be to spend all of eternity in the act of killing yourself in the same way you used to die. So Al-Qaeda approaches this by saying, no, they're not suicides. They are martyrs. And by falling into that category, they are able to claim all these rewards in paradise, the 72 virgins and all the great things that are promised for martyrs in the Quran and other writings in Islam.
So John, let's move on to Mexico now. Can you give us an overview of what's happening there? What is this war that's being waged with the cartels against the Mexican government and the U.S.? And also, the cartel, the Zetas, what makes them extremely powerful and also very savvy propagandists?
It's bad enough that nearly 50,000 people have died in the drug war in Mexico in the last 5 years, with another 5,000 missing. But the depiction of some of these crimes have become a sort of a sideshow to this war. The Zetas are one of the two dominant cartels in Mexico, the Sinaloans being the others. The Zetas, made up of former special forces who were originally the enforcers for the Gulf Cartel, then they broke away and became their own criminal syndicate. They roughly control the entire eastern half of Mexico. And they have really grown into one of the most cinematically brutal group of criminals that I think we've ever seen before. Using new media, using violence as a tool of communication in ways that are shocking to people who've watched organized crime in Latin America for a very long time. Just to sort of pick the connective tissue up from where Larry left off, a lot of people say that it's no coincidence that the first videotaped decapitations of Mexican police occurred in 2006 when Al-Qaeda beheadings were shown on Mexican television. I'm not sure any of us have been able to interview heads of the Zetas as to, you know, where they got this idea, but there seemed to have been a movement from the Middle East into Mexico at the same time. There's also an interpretation that this was a nod to how when the Aztecs would behead their captives as a way to dominate their foes, that this was, you know, somehow going back to antiquity in Mexico. But to speak about the Zetas, I mean, we purposely decided not to have show and tell pictures here because these images are so fantastically gruesome, and they've created their own desensitization of people in Mexico also, which I think we'll probably talk about in a minute. But the Zetas signed their crimes with a Z. There was a poor woman who was a journalist in Nuevo Laredo who last year was one of those taking advantage of social media to alert people in the city about where the Zetas were and what they were up to and what places to avoid. And at the time, the Zetas wanted to send a message, you need to stay, we know you're blogging about us, we don't like it, we don't like you tweeting about us, we want you to stay away from social media and don't give away our location. And so they captured her, they decapitated her, they hanged her body from, no, that was an earlier one, they threw it in a public square, left her head in a planter along with some computer parts, including her laptop, with a message saying, hi, my name is Nena, this is what happens when I'm online too much, basically. This has had an incredibly chilling effect on the use of social media in Nuevo Laredo. So that's the Zetas. Now, how do they get their message out? They don't have their own channel. They don't have sympathetic websites that are pro-narco in the way that there are extremist Islamic websites that show some of these atrocities in the Middle East. I want to call your attention to one of the most popular websites in Mexico. It's called Blog del Narco. And it's a phenomenon. One British journalist called it a catalog of horror. It's almost like an online snuff film. They show pictures of bullet-riddled bodies to on-screen beheadings and executions. It's all contributed content. Anyone can offer this up. Their explanation is that, well, we're showing the pictures, the images of the real drug war in Mexico that the Mexican press is too afraid to show. And there's some truth to that, in that in the areas where the cartels are really powerful and really vindictive, like the Mexican-Texas border, the media has been terrorized into silence, and they can't show these images, and they can't write about it. They can't even breathe a word. They can't even say the name of the cartel boss because they're under strict instructions to not to. And so Blog del Narco does offer up these images, but it's also turned into this sort of commercial franchise, which is very bizarre. When I was writing a story about this in September of last year, you could go onto this website and literally next to a picture of a pile of severed heads, you saw ads for the New Orleans Convention and Visitors Bureau, GM Truck Month, Geico Auto Insurance, Volvo, AT&T, and my favorite, Lysol Toilet Bowl Cleaner. And I wrote pretty pointedly about this also. Now granted, this is the way that I understand advertising on the net works, is that these corporations don't necessarily know where their ads are going. They just go, you know, the pages that get the most viewers, that get the most page hits, you know, that's where their ads go. So we can't really blame, you know, GM for advertising there. However, it was really shocking. I visited the site a couple of days ago. There were no ads. And in fact, now they have columns for political news and for, you know, sort of a little bit more legitimate news. And so the critics of Blog del Narco say that what these images do is that the cartels post their victories, they post their intimidation videos, they post their exploits, not just as a way to frighten their rivals, to menace the rival cartel, but also as a kind of a recruitment tool. And this is where it really gets weird, because what's called narcocultura in Mexico has now become, it's all of this has moved into the entertainment realm. While one segment of Mexican society is recoiling in horror from these images that they're seeing on their streets from their relatives who are being kidnapped in Matamoros and all these places, and where the authorities just stand by and do nothing, another segment of Mexican society, and in fact, a lot of people, because the internet is available everywhere in the world, is kind of gloating over these pictures also. And granted, there have been tabloid crime exploitation newspapers on the streets of Latin America for years. When I lived in Guatemala in the 1980s, there was one called Extra, and all of the firemen who would go collect the bodies during the dirty war in Guatemala in the 80s would have cameras, and they would take pictures of these mutilated bodies, and then they would sell them to this crime rag, and that's how they made extra money. So this has gone on for a long time, but it's gone to an entirely new phase now with the internet and with the fantastic popularity of Blog del Narco.
I'd like to get into a little bit the significance of controlling the myth, you know, of the Zetas controlling the myth and their mythology surrounding them and controlling the narrative and the story, and also Al-Qaeda. But you had mentioned that we're not only seeing these things, and they're not only on the internet, but they're in pop culture, they're in songs and clothes.
Yeah, I want to mention this is narcocultura covers a lot of media, of entertainment in Mexico. There's narco cinema, there are narco novellas, a lot of them produced in Colombia, and there are narco corridos. This is the voice of Valentin Elizalde, who was one of the most renowned narco corridistas. A narco corrido is a ballad about a drug lord, basically, or about a famous smuggling operation or about a drug lawyer, anything having to do with narco culture. And they are wildly popular, not just in Mexico, but also in communities here in the United States. Valentin Elizalde, who was from Sinaloa, he is associated with the Sinaloa cartel. He sang this song, A Mis Enemigos, to my enemies, on November 25th, 2006, at a concert at a cockfight arena in Reynosa. This is deep in Zeta Gulf territory. While he was leaving this, he was machine gunned. When he was in having his autopsy done, the Zetas sent some cameramen in, and they actually filmed his lifeless body riddled with bullets with the audio of these gangsters laughing about it. So, and then this again, this went up on YouTube before they were quickly taken down. It may have gone up on one of the blogs also. Narco corridos have turned into this huge sensation in Mexican popular music. He actually, Elizalde, was posthumously nominated for a Latin Grammy. He's compared to Pedro Infante, even, and there are many others like him. Mexican radio has banned narco corridos because the government says, you shouldn't be glorifying these drug lords. Even 2 weeks ago, Los Tigres del Norte, one of the most famous bands, norteño bands in Mexico, was banned from a concert in Chihuahua City because they had sung a song called La Reina del Sur, which was about a female drug lord, Sandra Avila Beltran. And so, like soccer fans, there are, or rather like sort of people who are loyal to, soccer fans, different corrido artists align themselves with different cartels. And then they write songs lionizing the cartels. And sometimes they're commissioned by the drug lords to write a song about them, which is sort of one of how you prove to the world that you've arrived. This is a quick example here. Hold the bottom of that, Rebecca. This is Chuy Quintanilla. This is just one of many, 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 many that he lives in Matamoros. He's a former federal policeman turned narco corridista, and his specialty is writing songs that celebrate the Gulf cartel. And as he told me in an interview one time, I've learned things in my long life in law enforcement. So,
this puts journalists and writers in a very precarious position, because as you mentioned, something that you had written sparked an idea of further violence. What is this line that you have to walk that pertains to this third dimension, I guess we could call it, of journalism, which is the citizen journalism? And it's not really journalism, but sensationalism. How do you report on the sensationalism, the spectacle, without perpetuating the narrative or scaring people to death?
First of all, there are two trends going on. One is, the rise of social media, which I think is in many respects terrific, because it has access to things that we can't get. The second trend being the decline of established media. For more than two decades, the foreign correspondents, for instance, have diminished. ABC used to have 30 bureaus around. They don't have any foreign bureaus now. There used to be something like 600 American foreign correspondents, and now there are fewer than 300. And it devolves on people like me and John, who parachute into places. And, we try to get up to speed, but, we don't live there. And you have a situation like in Iran, where we wouldn't know anything if it hadn't, during the Green Revolution, had it not been for those cell phone cameras. The same thing's true in Syria right now. So they won't let me in. I can't go back to Syria right now. And so we're absolutely dependent on that. So there's a weakness of the established press, which fails to fill in the context. that I think people need to understand this incredibly sensational information that they're getting. And that kind of information tends to be more tabloid than tabloid. I think it's very difficult for, the established press is too weak to press up against this right now. And I think that's why you'll see more and more of this coming in, not just in Mexico and not just in Al-Qaeda, but you'll see that the internet becoming the main carrier of information, however reliable or unreliable it may be.
John, did you want to comment on that, some of your challenges in reporting on this?
Yeah, and I think in Mexico, this debate is really playing itself out in public constantly, because now Blog del Narco has its imitators, Mundo Narco. And it's interesting, as I was on Mundo Narco, the world of the narcos today, in print it says it collaborates with the Blog del Narco for a better Mexico. And I kind of thought about that for a while, because they can still say that they're daring to broadcast post the images that other media are afraid to, which is only partially true, because there's a lot of media in Mexico which is very courageous and very aggressive. But what is this actually doing to the people who, and this is where it gets into pornography, I think, when you start to look at these images and you casually scroll through headless corpses and bodies with their sex organs cut off and stuffed in various places. I mean, just unspeakable stuff. What happens? The Mexican government has banned narco-corridos because they presumably influence youth to want to, to be a drug lord. And of course, it just makes the drug songs even that sexier, just like gangster rap. The same thing was happening with it, And they say, and you ask them, well, what are you doing? Well, we're just telling you how things are on the streets. And that's what the people at Blog del Narco and the narco-corridos would tell you are doing. But what effect is it having on the audience? And as journalists, we also follow it. I know I have friends contacts in the DEA who follow Blog del Narco to keep track of who's saying what, which cartel committed which crime, what are they taking credit for. And I know that the Mexican investigators do the same thing. So, there is sort of news value to it.
All wars have had this. We should never think that war goes without this kind of thing. But to some extent, like in World War II, when Americans were cutting off the heads of Japanese soldiers and putting them on trees and vice versa, those were private messages. They were saying to the enemy, look what can happen to you. We are trying to scare you. They weren't meant to be broadcast all over the world. When American soldiers in Vietnam were cutting off the ears, they were souvenirs, but they were to some extent shameful outside of the context. So I think what we're talking about right now has a different charge to it.
What's really significant, though, about this point is that there is this mythology behind it. And so maybe you could talk about how the Zetas use this mythology of the Robin Hood-esque.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, because I think the kind of lionization of some of these super criminals in Mexico begins with what you said. It begins with powerless people who feel oppressed by a corrupt government, poor, and they're in some ways cheering on people who are giving it to the federales, who are giving it to the DEA, who are sly like the fox. Like Chapo Guzman, who, the richest, most powerful drug lord who they can't seem to catch. And that began with the origin of corridos began with the Revolutionary War the Mexican Revolution, when Pancho Villa, there are many famous corridos written about him. I mean, and many of you probably know that Americo Paredes, the great folklorist here at UT documented some of this. But now this is being taken to a pathological level. There has been an inflation of barbarism such that when you kill an enemy, and then you skin him and you stitch his face to a soccer ball, which happened in Michoacan. Where does it stop? And that's the terrifying thing in Mexico. There seems to be, you know, beheadings are passé now. What's next?
I would like to open it up to questions, if anyone has a question.
My name's Wolf Dilworth. I'm a retired veteran on the front overseas. I involved early on in my career with conflict, everything from the Iran oil platform bombings, Gulf War I, Kosovo, and the Second Gulf. My main concern is with our own glorification of war here at home. It became, at first, with the recent, Gulf conflict, the troops going over, being rounded up from, the poor neighborhoods and such. But then there's this shift now where we're making heroes out of our veterans when they come home from these conflicts. There's TV programs that really just give me a lot of concern. I never asked for any kind of praise for my service, and it cheapens, when a service member comes back and he, is reunited with his family, that's a private thing. And to put that on public display is just, it's bizarre to me.
Well, it does touch on the question of media and the relation between the kind of work I do, in the movies and violence and I've written things that show violence. I don't believe that I glorify it, but violence is a part of our lives. Does what I do cause violence? I've struggled with this because people are dead because of a movie I wrote. I don't think that I'm responsible for their deaths, but I can't deny that they would be alive if I hadn't written the movie. So there's a heavy responsibility that goes along with it. Art can be dangerous, and it can be contagious. Schlock is not. I think schlock can be desensitizing. I think, Al-Qaeda used to watch Arnold Schwarzenegger's movies and stuff like that, Rambo and those kinds of things. And I think that can desensitize you to violence, but I think people that are prone to violence seek out those kinds of things. It's a different quality when you have something like Taxi Driver, a famous movie that John Hinckley so radically identified with that he went out and shot Ronald Reagan. There are many different, another example, for instance, is Basketball Diaries, Leonardo DiCaprio movie, where it's actually an anti-drug movie. It's a very fine movie, but there's a brief dream sequence in there where he is walking in a black duster with a gun through a schoolyard, killing people. And kids started, this became a kind of cultural trope. The schoolyard killings, he's not responsible for them, but he's framed the style to some extent in an anti-drug movie. The message of the movie is completely opposite to what some minds took out of it. So the lesson I take from this is that art is perilous. You don't know what kinds of responses there are going to be from what you put out there.
Yeah, I just kind of briefly, I appreciate what you're doing as you're also helping to take the discussion north of the border, and I think there's value in that. And what I'm thinking about is, there are some kids who've come of age. All we've known is war for 10 years now in this country. And we have brought the images of combat in Iraq and Afghanistan into very, very popular video games now. My son Willie is out here somewhere. What are the names of some of the video games now that are?
Modern Warfare.
What is another one? Badge of Honor? Or? Call of Duty. Yeah, that's it. I mean, these are like super popular games. You know, they're certainly glorifying it.
And whether or not it's, you know, working to desensitize people or to hypersensitize people, you know, to make them extremely sensitive to these issues of like reunion. I think what's interesting is that we're not strangers to this type of propaganda. This has been going on, you know, forever, especially since World War II, when people like John Guyerson were making movies like Heart of Britain, you know, to beef up the home front. So there's this fine line between getting the government involved and then also just the role and the responsibility that artists have to remain independent.
We have another question to your right.
I would ask, you know, talking about this has happened forever. I mean, we think of this country with the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, the visual drama and horror is very compelling, and it seemed it took a long time for the aspect of law to come in. In many of these areas you're talking about in the world, there's almost like void of that. Is there any movement up front that's helping with that kind of rule of law of settling some of these?
Quite sure I understood what you mean.
For example, the Ku Klux Klan, with what was going on, in fact, not too long ago here, I think in East Texas, it took the rule of law before some of those terrible acts upon other people, very violently, very visual, were stopped, right? Burning of crosses, et cetera. But in these countries right now, it seems like there's not on the horizon a way that's going to help come in to put an end to the violence.
Well, yeah, and you're talking about countries that have one hand tied behind their back and have a lot of corruption, and maybe there's a lot of issues involved. You know, why countries can't bring, you know, insurgents or criminals under control. They're also using a bottom-up and end-around way to get to the media. That's the genius of social media, is that you can be anywhere and you can do this. But I also, I'm reminded of the Klan that has become sort of, it, to the extent that it still exists, which it's so much weakened now, it's kind of a media creation. This gets into, you know, the journalistic ethics. I mean, I've covered Klan rallies in the South a few times, and if there aren't TV cameras there, there's nothing, you know, there's really nothing going on. There's maybe 12 Klansmen and 400 protesters, and the TV cameras create the moment. That's why they're there, because that gives them force multiplication. That's another discussion we should have in journalism school.
There's another question right back here.
Yes, I wanted to ask about violence in this country. In the latter half of the 20th century, you have the emergence of this myth of redemptive violence in popular culture, I think exemplified by the idea of the American cowboy in John Wayne films, this idea that there was one man, it was the responsibility of one man or person to bring justice. And you see this in every John Wayne movie ever made, and also like in High Noon, Gary Cooper, and how this idea sort of permeates, mainly informs why America chooses to go to war.
Well, here I am, a movie maker and a conscientious objector. And but I love those John Wayne movies. And there's something, I think, you know, I don't think they always glorify violence. There's certainly an amazing, I think one of the things that art of any kind can do, but movies do more than most, is explore our attitudes towards violence. And you know the John Wayne movies typically present him as that character that you talk about, but then there are other movies that I think about, like Unforgiven, which is a Clint Eastwood movie. I think is absolutely fascinating because it's one of the most deplorable people, And yet, because you're watching him, you can't help but cheer him on. That's the danger of that kind of art. And I love that movie. And I'm not willing to give it up. I don't think that our movies are more violent than a lot of other cultures. It's just that, you know, we have this myth about the Old West that we continually return to, because to some extent it helps us understand how we could be in this world. And I think they're morality stories. But anyway, as I said, I'm a conscientious objector, so I feel a lot of ambivalence about it.
Something to think about is a conversation I was having with Jorge San Luis Leon, was that maybe perhaps also the medium by which we're watching them is influencing the way that we're ingesting the material. So you're watching on a big screen and you suspend your disbelief and you walk out and you know that what you've seen isn't real. But when you're watching, you know, your daughter playing with a ball and then, you know, a cat or something and then a beheading on the same player, maybe something to think about is what happens to your psyche when all of this
Rebecca, there's an interesting series of studies that have been done on, you know, media, the role of media in stimulating violence. And one of the most intriguing was done in Canada, because Canada was delayed in getting television after the United States. And there was enough time and enough alarm in this country to think, you know, what's happening to our country because of television? And so a study was put in place as television was introduced in Canada. And sure enough, violence rose markedly. But what was on Canadian TV? Cartoons and soccer. There was practically, you know, no violent programming at all, and yet violence did increase. So the conclusion of the authors of the study was that the medium itself was provocative, not the message. And I don't know. I mean, there are plenty of different studies that you can throw up and say this or that. But I think that stimulation of cultural stimulation sometimes results in violence.
Go ahead. Where are you, Kayla? Oh, there you are.
Hi. My question is about Al Jazeera. In the beginning of the Iraq War, people were really kind of crying foul that Al Jazeera was playing the Al-Qaeda videos and everything. But in retrospect, was that a factor? I mean, or were they just doing the kind of reporting that you're struggling with now?
Well, I was in Saudi Arabia during the Iraq War, and so I was watching the war on Fox and Al Jazeera, which are two similar networks in some ways. And each of them had a narrative that they were propounding. Fox was the liberation of the oppressed Iraqi people and how they're going to be dancing in the streets. And sure enough, you saw people dancing in the streets on Fox. And on Al Jazeera, the narrative was the continuing humiliation of the Arabs. And you saw countless shots of the Arab troops walking, you know, the Iraqi troops in surrender. But the thing that I will never forget is something that I saw originally on CNN. And it was of, there was a retired American general who'd gotten one of those jobs where they, you know, they, like a sports announcer, you know, they take you through. And he had a turtleneck like this with his, you know, sleeves pulled up, and he had a little pointer. And it was two American soldiers who were entering an Iraqi house, or, you know, calling the occupants out. And he was pointing at him and said, you know, notice that they're standing on either side of the doorway. You know, they're knocking on the door. And, you know, the door opens, and you see the father looking out, and he's pointing his... Notice that their fingers on the outside of the trigger guards. You know, everything is being done by the book. And he's going on, and the family comes out terrified. absolutely terrified. And there's this little girl whose eyes are just as big as saucers. And you can, your lips trembling. And the family is made to kneel in front of the American soldiers. And the general on CNN says, notice how the American soldiers have taken control of the situation. Well, you can watch that on CNN, but when you see it on Al Jazeera, as it was shown again and again and again, is a completely different experience because it exemplified so thoroughly the story that they were trying to tell.
I just want to share one anecdote. The NPR house in Iraq used to be right across the street from the Fox house, and so we actually used to party together. All of the broadcast outlets were in the same sort of enclave, and we became good friends with them. And some of the broadcast people, some of the war correspondents were very, very good at Fox. And one of them was a Scot who was just a hard-hitting, straight-shooting journalist. And he told me that they wanted to do, I'll try to do his impression. He said one night the editor in Washington said he wanted to do this very friendly story on a U.S. general who'd just been posted there, and a kind of a wet kiss, you know, story on the general. And he said they wanted me to get foxy on him. I told him to fuck off. So you just, Fox is not all what you think it is.
John, short term and long term, what's the future of the Texas-Mexican border from Ciudad Acuña to Matamoros?
On which side?
Los dos.
Things aren't near as bad as we're being told here on the Texas side. And it's worse than you can imagine on the Mexican side. Right across the border. I mean, and I don't know if anyone actually saw there was a very fine story in the New York Times on Sunday about a family that had 18 members kidnapped in Matamoros, and they're utterly powerless to get any justice because the authorities are either corrupt or they're frightened. And I'm a native Texan. I've traveled in all these towns, and when I used to, you know, go and drink tequila and eat and have a good time, and they're off limits for most people. And I think I don't think the future is gonna be that superior law enforcement is going to finally contain the cartels, which is the strategy of Mexico City. But I do think that the best hope is that they can try to revert to an older model in which there were one or two cartels which understood that ultra violence is bad for business. It heats up the plaza, and gets back to the model of just doing business, and not spilling quite as much blood. But the Zetas, to get back to where we started, they have brought an entirely new concept to organized crime in Mexico, and that is it's not just blood to accomplish your economic ends, but blood for sport. And blood, bloodlust.
One thing I thought I should touch on before we finish is that these regimes that many of the Arab countries, or at least I'm speaking of, have a long history of their own of a kind of spectacular terror, and Egypt was certainly that way in the 90s, and what happened recently with the Arab Spring. When I think about the Arab Spring, I like to tell people about the civil rights movement, which, you know, was, I think, the most transformative movement in our country's history since the Civil War. And there's a plaque in Montgomery for the martyrs of that movement, and there are 40 names on it. You know Martin Luther King, you may know Emmett Till and Medgar Evers, but most, you know, you don't know the three little girls in Birmingham, but 40 names. 840 people died in Egypt in 17 days of their revolution. And we don't know how many in Syria. 2,000 reported today killed in Yemen. The scale of the deaths is unbelievable. And a lot of it is prompted by the kind of violence that we're talking about. In Egypt, at the very beginning, just before this revolution, there was a young man in Alexandria named Khaled Said, yeah. And he was in an internet cafe, and he was picked up by a couple of cops and taken to the police station and brutally tortured, they said that he swallowed a packet of hashish and died accidentally, but his body was given to his family. And, you know, they recorded what the government, you know, what these cops had done to him. And a Google executive named Wael Ghonam started a movement called We Are All Khaled Said, and his picture, those gruesome photographs were on posters that then went into Tahrir Square. So that was, you know, as a reaction against that kind of violence. In Syria, similarly, there was a 13-year-old boy who was writing graffiti on the wall, and the cops picked him up. They returned him to his family 30 days later. He had been beaten, burned, strangled, shot, and castrated. And they handed his body back as a message. But he also became, you know, a symbol of what these people are fighting against.
We have time for just one more question before we wrap things up. And then I really hope that people have time to stay around and have another drink and maybe continue the discussion.
I teach at ACC. And I recently encountered an anesthesiologist from Mexico, medical degree, who was enrolled in freshman English in order to have a student visa as a means of escaping a shakedown just because his father was a doctor and the family had some money. And this was totally separate from any narco culture. Could you comment on how it's spreading beyond the drug situation?
And that also is a hallmark of the Zetas, is that they have become a full-service mafia, involved not just in smuggling drugs, but in alien smuggling, in extensive extortion, kidnapping, even stealing petrochemical products from Pemex. And it's not just the Zetas. There's such impunity in these cities along the U.S.-Mexico border and now into the interior, so much impunity by the criminals that there's all of these wannabes and spinoffs. And so you have myriad gangs of young toughs who do the same things as the Zetas do. And so it's this atomization of crime which has turned some of these areas of Mexico into a nightmare, where no one is safe if you have any money, and the authorities won't help you, and it's not about drugs. It used to be about drugs, and now it's just kind of generalized criminality, because that's how the bad guys go out and get paid. And so we are seeing this. Texas, many of our cities are seeing this exodus of Mexicans, in Austin as well. For Monterey, yeah, that's become a very dangerous place.
Well, I would like to thank you both. I think this has been a really illuminating discussion, but I think it's also just begun. Is there anything that you would like to leave us with, any final thoughts on the topic?
Well, I think speaking about Al-Qaeda, it's going to fade away one day. They always do. But what worries me is that Al-Qaeda created a template which I think is spilled over into Mexico and probably other places that we haven't talked about, where small groups, even individuals, are super empowered by technology and by the example that terrorists have given them. And I think we won't see the end of it. We're going to have to continually cope with new forms of it. And it's going to be a great challenge for the rest of our lives, at least.
I'm picking up that thread. Mexico has always been very powerful culturally in Latin America. They've been great singers and telenovelas, you know, popular music. I mean, I've been in lots of countries in Latin America, and so you sense this. And now you have criminality, really phenomenal crime waves in Latin America, certainly in Central America. And so what I worry is that the popularization of narco culture is going to start to bleed into the places where the narcos have now moved, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador,
and the United States.
There, well, some of these images are popular in some areas of the U.S., but not to that degree.
Well, I would like to thank you not only for coming tonight, but also for the amazing work that you both do. Thank you very much. And thank you all for coming this evening. Let's give a big hand to our guests.
You've been listening to KUT's Views and Brews Remix, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, on the new pornography of violence, with guests John Burnett, an NPR foreign correspondent, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author and playwright Lawrence Wright. This program was made possible by Casey Cheek, our sound engineer, James Morgan, Chris Luwak, Angela Maldonado, Aaron Randall, Jorge Sanhueza-Lyon, Rick McNulty, Matthew McCrary, Hawk Mendenhall, Rachel Neal, Kayla Gabriel, Matt Munoz, and Amy Chambliss. Catch more of KUT's Views and Brews on our website. That's KUT.org. I'm Rebecca McEnroy. Thanks for listening.